So we're continuing with the story of project appraisal. This is the final lecture on project appraisal. We were looking at an example. So let me quickly reprise with you what the story was. We were looking at a 5-year investment. An investment in a new piece of machinery that would cost us £2,800 today, times zero. But in order to be able to do something with that machinery, we would also have to add to our existing working capital. So there's a further investment necessary, and in total, that's an additional £1,300. That addition to the working capital comes in two forms. We have to buy in some raw materials that we will work on with our new machine, but we also have to top up our cash at bank, as the accountants call it. We might need to draw on that slush fund, if I might call it, depending on how things go. So our total investment today is £4,100. In the absence of corporation tax, if I were now to draw a cash flow diagram representing this investment, I would draw a downward pointing arrow whose size was £4,100. Let's now fast forward to the end of the economic or working life of the project and familiarise ourselves with the numbers here. The machine we reckon, on the basis of what we know today, we reckon that machine will be sold, we'll be able to sell it on for only £100. That's essentially its scrap value. So its working life is essentially at an end. Now that's partly because of wear and tear in this individual machine, but it's mostly a reflection of technological innovation. We might assume that the machine we buy today represents state-of-the-art technology. That technology will not remain state-of-the-art. With technological innovation, new machines, machines that are faster, cleaner, more efficient will be invented. The best we reckon we can sell that machine for at the end of its working life is £100. But we'll still have that, thank you very much. The working capital, on the other hand, we expect to be able to realise in full. I'm assuming no inflation. So I don't have to worry about inflating any of these numbers to account for inflation. So you should note down, if you haven't already, that these two items, and for my purposes I might as well group them together to make 1300, they are equal and opposite to the initial entries. So what I spend in setting up, in adding to my working capital today, I expect to be able to recover in full at the end of the project's working life. So again, in the absence of corporation tax, I will have an arrow, a cash flow arrow, 5 years from now. Is it 1400? No. It's 1400 plus whatever cash flow I expect to generate from operations. And that's the other part of the story. So the numbers are telling us that each year, operating this machinery as we plan, we expect to generate operating cash flow. That's the difference between the revenue from selling whatever it is we're producing minus the costs, the direct costs involved in that production process. We expect to be able to generate operating cash flows of 1,000 each year. And as you've seen me do in the seminar, to keep things simple, I assume that those operating cash flows appear magically as a lump sum at the end of each year. In reality, of course, those operating cash flows would be generated throughout the year. But that will make my calculation more difficult. So, at the end of the project's life, I recover 1,400 from selling the machine for a measly 100. I recover 1,400, that's 100 from the machine, plus the 1,300 I recover from working capital, but topped up with one final cash flow from operations. So my final cash flow arrow, 5 years from now, is 1,400 plus 1,000, that's 2,400. In between, at the end of year 1, 2, 3 and 4, there's a cash flow of 1,000. Now if I were you, I would draw a little cash flow diagram on the slide, just to remind me. But you need to make it clear to yourself, that's in the absence of corporation taxes. Absent any tax effects, the cash flow diagram looks like minus 4,100 today, plus 1,000, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, and 4 years out into the future. 5 years out into the future, that final cash flow is 1,400 plus 1,000, so that's 2,000 400. The discount rate we're being told at the bottom of the slide is 10%. So one of the things you should do for yourself is calculate the NPV of this project in the absence of corporation taxes. You could then compare that answer with the answer we're going to get when we worry about corporation taxes. The visualizer is dead today, so let's go back to the old overhead projector. So that's the same slide as is on the left, and I'm now going to replace it with a transparency that summarizes what's on the next slide in your pack. So that's going to give me something that I can point to. So these numbers are in your pack. So I need to remind you then how corporation tax works. In the presence of corporation tax, the company can enjoy capital allowances. Now, the manner in which the capital allowances are calculated, as I showed you last time, look just like depreciation. But there's a key difference. Depreciation is what the company's own accountants do to write down the value of the fixed assets on the balance sheet of the company. And they decide on the writing down schedule. We don't have such license when it comes to tax allowances. We have to follow the rules that the tax man imposes. And what I'm assuming here is that the book value, the written down value of the machine, is written down according to a 25% reducing balance method. And I showed you a little graph last time of how the numbers were calculated. So, when we bought the machine, it cost us $2,800. 25% of that is $700. There's your first capital allowance. And it turns out you can take that capital allowance straight away. So that's why the $700 appears in column zero. That first capital allowance is available today. That's part of the incentive that the tax man is providing the company with to encourage it to make such investments. The first capital allowance is $700, so now the written down value of the machine is $2,100. Take away the $700 from the initial value. So that's how we get the written down value after 1 year. The next capital allowance is going to be 25% of that. That's 25% of 2,100, that's 525. And so it goes on. So what you should convince yourself, with the exception of the entries in the last column, the column that's furthest to the right, I want you to convince yourself that as you go further and further to the right, each number in the row for written down value is 75% of the previous number. We've written the previous number down by 25%. So check, convince yourself that's true of these numbers. Convince yourself it's also true of the numbers in the row of the table that represents the capital allowance. Each number is 75% of the previous number, with the exception of the very last capital allowance. And I explained at the end of the last lecture that the last capital allowance is a balancing allowance. The tax man thinks along the following lines. According to his writing down schedule, the book value of the machine at the end of year 5 is 664. We anticipate that we'll only be able to sell it for 100. So we anticipate selling it at a loss of 564. The tax man says you can have all of that loss as one final balancing allowance. So that's why the final capital allowance is much bigger. It breaks the trend. So these numbers that are written along this row, capital allowance, at the foot of the slide, they are reproduced up here. Now what I want you to understand is what we do with those capital allowances once we've got them. And the answer is we use them to reduce the company's taxable income. Now you've got to be clear on this. What the capital allowances are doing is providing a shield against the tax man. We're reducing the amount of our income on which we have to pay tax. Now, currently, the corporation tax rate in this country is 28%. Come April, it drops to 27%. Well, I'm just going to assume it's 30% because it's a nice round number to work with. We pay 30% of our taxable income each year as corporation tax. However, the capital allowance is used to reduce the taxable income. Therefore, the effect of the capital allowance is to reduce how much tax we pay by 30% of the capital allowance. What the capital allowance is doing is reducing the amount of taxable income, the amount of income on which we pay tax. We pay tax at 30%. So the tax we actually pay is reduced, not by the capital allowance, but by 30% of the capital allowance. You've got to be clear on that. So that's what's going on up here in the higher rows of this table. We've already got the numbers regarding revenue and operating expenditure, and every time I look at this table, I think the same thing, and I keep forgetting, why don't I just replace those two rows by the single row, operating cash flow? So if I had been switched on, I should have replaced these two rows simply by a stream of 1,000s in each of the 5 years. That's these numbers. I really must get round to making that change. So, absent the capital allowances, all of this 1,000 from operations would be taxable. But it's not. The capital allowances act as a cushion against the tax man. So we get to deduct the capital allowance from the operating cash flow. Notice in particular that in year zero, we haven't got any cash flows from operations, but we can still make use of that first capital allowance. At least, we can still make use of it if the company's activities overall, i.e. all the other projects it's undertaking, if those activities are overall profitable, the company can still avail itself of this first capital allowance. From the taxman's point of view, what matters is, what is the company doing overall, across all of its activities? The taxman is not particularly interested in this one individual project. So, you might want to write this down. Provided the company is in a tax-paying position, i.e., its activities are overall profitable, so it's having to pay tax, it can use this first capital allowance to offset the tax it has to pay on its other activities. I'm just representing it in the table as if it were being applied to this project. That just keeps things simple. So the effect of the capital allowances then is to reduce the taxable income on which the company pays corporation tax at 30%. Now, these numbers in this row labelled corporation tax, these are cash flows. The company pays tax with cash. And in handing over an amount of tax to the taxman, the company is giving up some of its cash flow. So generally, these cash flows come in with a minus sign. Except in year zero, where, if you like, there's a rebate from the taxman. The company's overall corporation tax bill across all of its activities will be reduced. It's effectively as if the taxman was saying, here, have £210 today, have it. Actually, the £210 doesn't come through the letterbox. You don't get a cheque from the taxman. He simply reduces the company's overall tax bill by £210. But that's fine. We'll still take account of it. It's there because of the capital allowances for this project. So we should associate it with this project. And so we do. So, go back now to the typed slide. These numbers in boldface type, these are cash flows. These are the amounts that the company is having to pay in corporation tax. Except the first one comes in with a plus sign because it's effectively a rebate. What matters when all is said and done then are the numbers in this final row. So we just tot up the numbers in each column. What I want you to notice is the following. Because the company pays corporation taxes, its cash flows in year 1, 2, 3, 4 and 5 are reduced by the amount of tax it pays. In year 0, its cash flow is uplifted because it gets a kickback from the taxman. What we care about at the end of the day when it comes to appraising this project, is it a good project or not, are these after tax, that's after corporation tax, cash flows. These are the numbers to use to draw your cash flow diagram. So in the presence of corporation tax, the cash flow diagram for this machine looks as follows. There's a downward pointing arrow. It's today. It's no longer 4,100. It's 3,890. Remember, we've benefited from that kickback from the tax man. At the end of year 1, 2, 3 and 4, the cash flow is no longer 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, 1,000. It's 858, 818, 789, 766. Because we've had to deduct how much we hand over, in cash flow terms, to the tax man. At the end of the project's life, the after-tax cash flow is 2,269. In the absence of tax, it would have been 2,400. But it's not. It's 2,400 minus what we've got to pay out in tax in the final year. So that's the cash flow diagram. If I were you, I would draw that on the slide to remind myself. If I were you, I would have drawn two cash flow diagrams. The one that represents the story when there is no corporation tax to worry about. The second one, which is the one we need, which is when there is corporation tax to worry about. I've done the calculation of the NPV in the case where there's corporation tax. You should do the calculation for yourselves in the case where there's not corporation tax, and you should compare the two numbers to see what is the effect of corporate tax. I'll leave that with you as an exercise. Okay, let's try and understand better what net present value is. By now, I hope everyone doing this module is clear that our tool for deciding whether a new investment is a good investment or not is to calculate its net present value. It sounds simple, and in theory it is. In practice, it's devilishly difficult. Because as you should now be able to appreciate, it involves two key steps. You've got to be able to forecast the incremental cash flows, and that involves including any opportunity costs, and that's usually the hard bit. Not missing out on, not forgetting about opportunity costs. So you've got to be able to forecast the incremental future cash flows, because those are the numbers that go upstairs in each term on the right-hand side of the expression you write down for the NPV. You've also got to know, or be able to estimate, the discount rate, big R, because that appears downstairs in every one of those terms on the right-hand side. And the purpose of the next lecture, which is on cost of capital, is to tell you how do we do that. So there are two key steps involved in project appraisal. Understanding why we're doing it is not so difficult. Actually implementing it in practice is, because there are lots of errors around. It's easy to introduce errors into your forecasting of the cash flows and into your estimation of the discount rate. So beware. In practice, it's trickier. And in practice, what analysts will do is they'll think up a number of different scenarios. So the really good times, average times, and the not so good times. And they've come up with three different sets of cash flow forecasts. They may also use a different discount rate for each of those scenarios. So they'll come up with what they think is a representative value for the NPV, assuming things work well, assuming things carry on pretty much as expected, and assuming things really don't turn out so well, and they'll use those numbers to decide, should we go with this project or not? That's how it works in practice. You wouldn't rely on one set of cash flow forecasts and one discount rate, and therefore one value of the NPV. There's too much uncertainty because you are having to look out into the future. But that begs the question, should you believe the value of NPV that you get? I mean, I can give you a cast iron way of obtaining a positive NPV. So if you are the project proposer, if you are the man or woman who wants to convince your bosses in the company, we really should undertake this project, and the way you're going to do it is by presenting all the facts and figures, all your estimates, and of course you want all of that to culminate in a positive NPV. Here's a surefire way of achieving it. Look at your cash flows, and if the number that you currently get for the NPV is negative, fiddle the cash flows. Inflate the cash flows. Raise your forecasts of the cash flows. If you raise them enough, you'll get a positive NPV. If you think, well, I can only push that so far before the boss picks up what's going on, all right, why don't you increase your cash flow forecasts to a degree, but you can also do something else. Reduce the value of the discount rate you use. So there's a double whammy here. You can make the numbers upstairs on the right-hand side a bit bigger, and you can use a slightly smaller number downstairs. Both of those changes work in the same direction. And it won't be too difficult for you to settle on a set of cash flow forecasts together with an estimate of the discount rate to use that together result in a positive NPV. Now there's just one catch. Your boss is probably alert to this. Maybe he or she did it earlier in their career. So they know to look out for these things. So they know to ask you some tricky questions. At the end of the day, they need to be persuaded that your positive NPV really is a positive NPV. So part of the story that you will have to give your boss is, where does that positive NPV come from? And I'll tell you now. The source of the positive NPV, if it's real and not invented, the source of the positive NPV is some form of competitive advantage. There has to be something about your company, the people in the company, the particular project you have in mind, such that when they come together, they can do it better than any other company. They have to have some competitive advantage. Now, it could be that it's the idea itself. I spent a year working for a company called Gillette. I was their principal research scientist, based in their labs in Reading. Gillette, as a company, is patent crazy. As soon as someone in the R&D lab has an idea, they get the company's lawyers to issue a patent. You can't copy it. That way, the competitors must keep their hands off that idea for at least 2 years. You can do a lot in those 2 years if you enjoy patent law protection. So there's one form of competitive advantage. You have a good idea, typically coming from your R&D lab, and you use the law to protect that idea, to keep the competition at a distance. It may be that your company has hired the best brains in the game. Now, in the field of investment banking, I'm not saying that the people that work for other banks aren't smart as well. I would hardly say that since I used to work for one called UBS. But I suppose Goldman Sachs would like to be thought of the cream of the cream. They hire the best brains. I don't know if they do or not. But it may be that the company has recruited perhaps the best scientists or the best engineers. They're more likely to come up with these ideas. If they're not coming up with the ideas, someone else might be in the company, they're best placed to implement those ideas. That could also be your competitive advantage. It could be that your company has a database of information. Information that it's gathered, say, through market research. It understands the needs and the wishes of the customers better than its competitors. That's all commercially sensitive information that can lead to a competitive advantage. So if you ever find yourself in the position where you're proposing a new project on the grounds that it's a positive NPV project, you'll never swing it. You'll never carry the day solely on the basis of your numbers, because you could have fiddled the numbers. Now, nobody would say fiddled. There could be some bias that's crept in either into your cash flow forecasts or into your estimate of the correctly risk-adjusted discount rate. More about that in the next lecture. In order to make the story compelling, you'll also have to explain to your managers, where does this positive NPV come from? And that will involve having to point to, explain, some form of competitive advantage, because that's what it is. When you look in the financial markets, when you look at the securities that trade in the equity market, so these are shares of listed companies, or in the large bond market, so these are large bonds issued by large borrowers, either the government, a government or a large corporation, these assets, these securities, are generally to be thought of as zero NPV investments. They're neither positive NPV or negative NPV. They're zero NPV. And the reason they're zero NPV investments is they're fairly priced. What you would pay today to buy those shares or that bond is the present value of all of the cash flows you expect in the future to receive because you now own those shares or that bond. In other words, our belief that the financial markets are highly efficient, and we've met that concept already, our belief that the financial markets are highly efficient at pricing securities implies those securities are zero NPV investments. Today's price is the correct price. Today's price is the present value of the expected future cash flows. And nobody believes that that's true of all of the securities all of the time. And indeed, we've talked about the role of financial analysts in last week's seminar classes. The financial analysts are always on the lookout for individual securities that are temporarily mispriced. These are the profit-making opportunities, in the jargon, the arbitrage opportunities. But at any point in time, the majority of the securities that are traded in the market are fairly priced. At any point in time, a few of them will be underpriced. They're selling cheap. And a few of them will be overpriced. They're expensive. And the analysts look to identify those and to issue recommendations: buy if they've spotted something that's underpriced, sell if they've spotted something that's overpriced. And the trading that that generates, the increased buying or selling activity, eliminates the mispricing. So generally the prices are kept very tightly, very close to where they should be. And in our idealized world, where the market is perfectly efficient, all securities are fairly priced. So the financial markets represent zero NPV investments. Not so a capital project like the one we've just been talking about. Why? Because there aren't many, many, many versions of this project being traded, bought and sold, in an active market. The world of investment in real assets is very different from the world of investment in financial assets. There really can be positive NPVs when you're looking at an investment in real assets. Those are assets you can touch, you can feel them, like buildings and machinery, things that you can do productive work with. There isn't a market out there in which large numbers of these projects are being bought and sold. It doesn't work like that. There isn't a market to keep the value embedded in these projects just where it should be. The reality is there's competitive advantage if you're smart enough. If you've got that good idea and you patent it, if you've got the people in place in your company to implement that good idea, you're away to the races. You've got a head start on the competition. And remember, the net present value is exactly that. Minus the initial investment today, plus the present value of the first cash flow, say a year from now, plus the present value of the second cash flow, 2 years from now, etc., etc. The further out in time you look, the heavier is the discounting. You're dividing by 1 plus r to the power 2. You're dividing by 1 plus r to the power 3, to the power 4. These numbers are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You're dividing by larger and larger numbers, so the present values are getting smaller and smaller. The ones that have the most impact are the ones that are closest in time to the present day. And that's the period whilst you enjoy patent protection. That's where the positive NPV is coming from. The positive NPV is coming from competitive advantage because in those early years, your competitors can't copy you. So you've got the market, the customer market, all to yourself in those early years. So the cash flows you can generate in those first few years are bigger because of that. But it's the cash flows in the first few years that matter most when it comes to determining net present value, because you have to discount them. But the near-term cash flows are not discounted as heavily as the far-term cash flows. That's the real reason why you've got a positive NPV. And that's what you need to explain to your bosses. I hope it doesn't shock you when I tell you I haven't given you the full story. I've led you to believe that the net present value is the tool for project appraisal. It's not true. We're limited in what we can do in this module. There is one deficiency embedded in the net present value method. It doesn't allow for flexibility. In the net present value calculation, the investment we're considering is a now or never opportunity. Typically, we're talking about today. It doesn't have to be today, it could be a year from now. But typically, it's today, and it's the decision we face is the following. Do we invest in this project now, or do we forget about it? The net present value method doesn't allow us to build in greater flexibility. Could we not wait a year and see what happens? No. No, you can't do that. The net present value method doesn't capture the additional value that the project might represent if it makes more sense to wait and see. Wait and see how fashions change. Wait and see how customer demand, customer tastes change. Maybe the product you have in mind or the service you have in mind to deliver, maybe it will become yet more popular. Maybe it won't be the runaway success that you think it is. So holding off for a year enables you to learn more. Of course, holding off for a year may cost you what's called first mover advantage unless you patent that idea. If you don't do anything for a year and you haven't taken the appropriate steps to stop the competition coming in, they could come in and mop up. Let's assume you have taken that protection. Waiting a year allows you to learn more. But of course, waiting a year postpones the point in the future when the cash starts rolling in from the project. If you've got a cash flow diagram in mind, if today you undertake the project, initial investment, big I, then a set of cash flow forecasts, C1, C2, etc., out into the future, fine. But if instead you want to hold fire, wait and see, that first cash flow in the future is going to be further in the future. So the advantage of waiting is you learn more, so your decision-making is better informed. The disadvantage is you hold off, you have to wait longer until the cash flows start rolling in. So there's a trade-off there. And the managers have to make that decision on the basis of that trade-off. What I'm saying to you is, what's missing in the valuation of the project, in the discounted cash flow approach, the net present value approach, is any notion of, can we attach a value to being able to wait and see? You can do that. You can think about the possibility of holding off, and you can evaluate how much additional value, could be positive, might be negative, that adds. But we don't have the machinery in this module to do that. You have to wait until Finance 1, until you learn about option pricing, to get the machinery for doing it. And you have to wait until Finance 2, until you get the chance to use that option pricing machinery in the context of corporate finance, in the context of calculating how much additional value is embedded in the project if you have the flexibility to wait and see. That's called a real option, because there's the option to wait regarding a decision involving real assets like factories and machinery. And this last slide lists for you some examples of real options, which I would just like you to be aware of. You don't need to know anything about them in any detail.